This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. Thank you for joining us this evening to hear Teju Cole read. My name is Amitava Kumar, and I'm here because I taught everything that Teju knows. Enough of some truth. I'm grateful to the Lannan Foundation for this invitation to participate in this celebration of Teju's writing. In this culture of ours, someone can say something stupid. I'm referring here to the likes of Donald Trump and Sarah Palin. As a matter of fact, I'm referring only to Donald Trump and Sarah Palin. Actually, as an aside, I don't know about you. I feel okay about Sarah Palin because she's responsible for the late blooming flower of romance in my life. I refer here, of course, to my secret love for the incredibly talented Tina Fey. End of aside. So, in this culture of ours, you'd have noticed, of course, that my last sentence went on forever like Sarah Palin's. In this culture of ours, in the media, we reward with scandalized attention or pure, naive fascination what is mindless or bigoted or just plain wrong. Sincere thanks, then, to spaces like this one, where we have gathered tonight, spaces that opt for seriousness over scandal, the space for questions, the arc of interrogation and self-reflection over the flatness of stale populist stump speeches, for the beauty and disturbance of art over the crimes of political and moral corruption. The thing about Teju Cole, though, is that more than any other writer or artist I know, he's himself adept at inventing new spaces for thinking and talking and doing art. Open City was such an opening. But not just that. We have seen him perform this role on Twitter and now more actively on Instagram, in sentient prose pieces in the New Inquiry or the New Yorker, in sharp, distilled commentary, even on his Facebook page, and over the past many months, in his role as a curator of images and as a critic of our ways of seeing in the pages of the New York Times Magazine. So much of this work is part of a long, ongoing moral deliberation on how we live, on how we are to act with dignity towards others and toward ourselves. This is exhausting and even thankless work. My malice shows. It shines when I often say to Teju that he's able to do all this only because he has no children. But as much as the seriousness of the project that I so constantly revel in is Cole's ability to tap into the human capacity for joy. We see this in his attention to work, to tools, to the poor, the banished, the buried, and the forgotten. There is always delight in the absurd, so much in evidence in his online project, Small Fates. Such lightness and such generosity in his gathering of flower correspondents from all over the world who posted pictures showing how spring was bursting into bloom in New York and New Zealand, in Guwahati and in Port-au-Prince in Haiti, in a parish in Surrey, and outside a bungalow in Dhaka. A really incisive thinker could perhaps have written the set of far-reaching tweets that were recognized as a critique of what got named the White Savior Industrial Complex. A wonderfully inventive artist might have come up with the idea of the story Hafiz collected in tweets or the flower correspondence report. What I find astonishing and end up celebrating, often on a daily basis, is the fact that Teju Cole does all these different things at once. I have simply registered and shared with you what I think often about Cole. These thoughts aren't new. I meditate on them with adequate envy all the time. I haven't told you anything about where he was born, where he lives or works, the many awards he has gathered. I think Wikipedia was created for that purpose. More important for me to share with you one last thought. V.S. Naipaul notes somewhere that when he began to write and travel, He felt that Joseph Conrad had been everywhere before him. I feel the same way about V.S. Naipaul, and it is possible that Teju, a great admirer of Naipaul's, shares this view. When it comes to Teju Cole, you don't so much note where he has been, though that's important. The truth about Teju is that you want to watch where he is going. Each fresh departure is a creative act, each station a new exercise in ingenuity. Whenever he gets there, it always comes as a surprise to catch the heart of God. I suspect it comes as a bit of a surprise to him too. He's more open to the experience than you are. This also means that he's already moving on. It is all very thrilling, and Teju, I'm very grateful to you for it. Please join me in welcoming Teju Cole.
Thank you. He taught me everything I know. That part was true. The rest is open to question. I'm very infrequently overawed by an occasion, and I find myself overawed at this moment because I'm very deeply honored to be here. But one of the ways in which we can judge and honor or the worth of it is to look at who is doing the honoring. And in this case, to be invited here by the Lannan Foundation and to be here in conversation with my dear friend Amitava Kumar makes me feel very deeply honored indeed. And I'm also very grateful for all of you who have joined us tonight. And I hope it will be a productive time and one in which we can make space for what else might happen. I actually want to start to my reading. I'm feeling a little bit nervous. I'm going to give myself some courage by reading somebody else's writing, somebody who writes better than I do, so that by kind of like contact infection, I may acquire some of their glory secondhand. I wanted to start by reading a short poem by one of my very favorite poets, and I know somebody who, until his untimely death a couple of years ago, was a good friend of the Lannan Foundation. So I want to read Postscript by Seamus Heaney as a way of saying thank you to you. Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter and inland among stones the surface of a slate-gray lake is lit by the earth lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You're neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open. I've got a collection of essays coming out in August, and it's entitled Known and Strange Things, from that line in that poem. This has very much been my very fortunate experience of the world these past many years, to encounter things that are comforting by their familiarity and to experience other things that push me into new modes of seeing and new modes of being. My first book published and the second one that appeared in this country is called Every Day's for the Thief. And this was a fiction about a man's return to Nigeria. So I'm going to read from that. And then after, I will read a longer piece that is an essay that will appear in Known and Strange Things. And then after that, I look forward to having a conversation with Amitava about these and other matters. The typical Lagos Danfo is yellow and decrepit and seats 14, two in front with the driver and three rows of four passengers each. The bus is operated by a team of two, the driver and a conductor, who is also known as the tout. In the typical bus terminus, such as those at Ojota, Yaba, Ikeja, or Ojodu, the air is thick with the cries of touts. They have to fill those 14 seats as quickly as possible and get a move on to their destination. Jota, 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 Jota. That's the man calling Ojota. Keja, 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 straight. That's the express to Ikeja bus stop. The sound that rises from the thrum of congested traffic is like a chorus of cantors or auctioneers. Balende CMS, Balende CMS, Balende, Balende, Balende. Touting is not a job. It is a way of being in the world, a distillate of pure attitude, the chest puffed out, the body limber, the jaw set to brook no opposition. There is in every tout the same no-nonsense attitude, the quick temper, the willingness to get into a fight over any and all conflicts. There is a strut they do, a swagger. These are the original wise guys of Lagos. Some of them are as young as 14. They do not go home in the evening and stop being touts. The thing is bound to their souls. The regular non-tout Lagosian, too, has to share this attitude. The body language as one moves through the street has to be one of undiluted self-assurance. Uncertainty in the face or gait attracts attention, and attention is bad. When you catch a stranger's eye, the message you send has to be unequivocal. Trust me, you don't want to mess with me. There are many people on these streets who roam around looking for victims, people who, through long practice, can sniff out weakness wherever it is. My uncle Bello, a well-built man in his 40s, told me about going to Oshodi Market and being accosted. A rough-looking man approached him on the Oshodi overpass and asked for money. My uncle thought about it and gave him 200 naira. The man was unimpressed. Ah, no, my money is 1,000. My uncle Bello said he had to assess at that point whether to call the guy's bluff or to cave into the extortion. He called his bluff. It was a bad move. The guy got extremely hostile. Eh? What do you mean by no? I will waste you. I will waste you. You see this bridge? I will dangle you from the edge. I'll throw you off. My uncle's options were suddenly limited. He knew that if he gave the thug the 1,000 naira, his whole wallet could get cleaned out. The man could tell him to take off his trousers or crawl on all fours in the dirt or something similarly humiliating. On the other hand, he really did look like the kind of guy who could make good on his threat of murder. Uncle Belo's instincts told him to fight fire with fire. He had lived in Europe for a long time, studying management in Krakow in the 1980s. In fact, he was still fluent in Polish. But he had also grown up in a relatively poor family and had had to fend for himself from an early age. So he knew the ways of the street. He started shouting at the man, "Waste me? Waste me? Are your eyes functioning? Look at me very well before you say another word. You don't recognize me. I will injure you. I will kill you. You understand? I will kill you. Do you know who you are talking to, huh? Do you know me? I will make your wife a widow." But of course, my uncle added with a deep laugh, the whole time I was saying this, I was quaking in my shoes like you wouldn't believe. The guy bought the act, though, and started begging my uncle to forgive him. Finally, my uncle gave him another 200, and they parted ways. About $3 had changed hands, and both lived to tell the tale. Lagos. So that's that. Thank you. This essay I wrote later on in 2014, so it's set in that year, and it is called Black Body. Longish, but not too long. You can take it, right? Came all this way. Then the bus began to drive into clouds, and between one cloud and the next, we caught glimpses of the town below. It was supper time, and the town was a constellation of yellow points. We arrived 30 minutes after leaving that town, which was called Loik. The train to Loik had come in from Visp. The train from Visp had come from Bern, and the train before that was from Zurich, from which I had started out in the afternoon. Three trains, a bus, and a short stroll, all of it through beautiful country, and then we reached Loikerbad in darkness. So Loikerbad, not far in terms of absolute distance, was not all that easy to get to. August 2, 2014. It was James Baldwin's birthday. Were he alive, he would be turning 90. He's one of those people just on the cusp of escaping the contemporary and slipping into the historical. John Coltrane would have turned 88 this year. Martin Luther King Jr. would have turned 85. People who could still be with us, but feel at times very far away, as though they lived centuries ago. James Baldwin left Paris and came to Loikerbad for the first time in 1951. His lover, Lucien Happersberger's family, had a chalet in a village up in the mountains. And so Baldwin, who was depressed and distracted at the time, went. And the village, which is also called Loeche-les-Bains, proved to be a refuge for him. His first trip was in the summer and lasted 2 weeks. Then he returned, to his own surprise, for two more winters. His first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, found its final form here. He had struggled with the book for 8 years, and he finally finished it in this unlikely retreat. He wrote something else too, an essay called Stranger in the Village. It was this essay, even more than the novel, that brought me to Loikerbad. Stranger in the Village first appeared in Harper's Magazine in 1953, and then in the essay collection Notes of a Native Son in 1955. It recounts the experience of being black in an all-white village. It begins with a sense of an extreme journey, like Charles Darwin's in the Galapagos or Tete Michel Pomassi's in Greenland. But then it opens out into other concerns and into a different voice, swiveling to look at the American racial situation in the 1950s. The part of the essay that focuses on the Swiss village is both bemused and sorrowful. Baldwin is alert to the absurdity of being a writer from New York who is considered in some way inferior by Swiss villagers, many of whom had never traveled. But later in the essay, when he writes about race in America, he's not at all bemused. He's angry and prophetic, writing with a hard clarity and carried along by precipitous eloquence. I took a room at the Hotel Mercure Bristol the night I arrived. I opened the windows to a dark view, but I knew that in the darkness loomed the Daubenhorn Mountain. I ran a hot bath and lay neck deep in the water with my old paperback copy of Notes of a Native Son. The tinny sound from my laptop was Bessie Smith singing, "I'm Wild About That Thing," a filthy blues number and a masterpiece of plausible deniability. "Don't hold it, baby, when I cry. Give me every bit of it, else I die. I'm wild about that thing." She could be singing about a trombone. And it was there in the bath, with his words and her voice, that I had my body double moment. Here I was in Loikerbad with Bessie Smith, singing across the years from 1929. And I'm black like him, and I'm slender, and I have a gap in my front teeth. And I'm short, and I'm cool on the page and animated in person, except when it is the other way around. And I was once a fervid teenage preacher. Baldwin, Nothing that has happened to me since equals the power and the glory that I sometimes felt when in the middle of a sermon I knew that I was somehow, by some miracle, really carrying, as they said, the word, when the church and I were one. And I, too, left the church, and I call New York home even when I'm not living there, and feel myself in all places, from New York City to rural Switzerland, the custodian of a black body, and have to find the language for all of what that means to me and to the people who look at me. The ancestor had briefly taken possession of the descendant. It was a moment of identification, and in the days that followed, that moment was a guide. From all available evidence, no black man had ever set foot in this tiny Swiss village before I came, Baldwin wrote. But the village had grown considerably since his visits, more than 60 years ago. They've seen blacks now. I wasn't a remarkable sight. There were a few glances at the hotel when I was checking in, and in the fine restaurant just up the road. But there are always glances. There are glances in Zurich, where I'm spending the summer, and there are glances in New York City, which has been my home for 14 years. There are glances all over Europe and in India, and anywhere I go outside Africa. The test is how long the glances last, whether they become stares, with what intent they occur, whether they contain any degree of hostility or mockery, and to what extent connections, money, or mode of dress shield me in these situations. To be a stranger is to be looked at, but to be black is to be looked at especially. Baldwin writes, "The children shout, 'Nager, Nager,' as I walk along the streets." Lurkerbad has changed, but in which way? There were, in fact, no bands of children on the street and few children anywhere at all. Presumably, the children of Lurkerbad, like children the world over, were indoors, frowning over computer games, checking Facebook, or watching music videos. Perhaps some of the older folks I saw in the streets were once the very children who had been so surprised by the sight of Baldwin, about whom, in the essay, he struggles to take a reasonable tone. Quote, "In all this, in which it must be conceded that there was the charm of genuine wonder and in which there was certainly no element of intentional unkindness, there was yet no suggestion that I was human. I was simply a living wonder." Close quote. But now the children or grandchildren of those children are connected to the world in a different way. Maybe some xenophobia or racism is part of their lives, but a part of their lives, too, are Beyoncé, Drake, Meek Mill, the music I hear pulsing from Swiss clubs on Friday nights. Baldwin had to bring his records with him in the 50s, like a secret stash of medicine, and he had to haul his phonograph up to Lurkerbad so that the sound of the American blues could keep him connected to a Harlem of the spirit. I listened to some of the same music while I was there as a way of being with him. Bessie Smith singing, "I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog on my roll." She was the best. Fats Waller singing, "Your feet's too big." I listened to my own playlist as well. Betty Swan, Billie Holiday, Gene Wells. Coltrane plays the blues, the physics, Childish Gambino. The music you travel with helps you to create your own internal weather. But the world participates too. When I sat down to lunch at the Römerhof restaurant one afternoon, that day all the customers and staff were white. The music playing overhead was Whitney Houston's "I Want to Dance with Somebody." History is now and Black America. At dinner at a pizzeria, there were glances. A table of British tourists stared at me. But the waitress was part black, and at the hotel, one of the staff members at the spa was an older black man. People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them, Baldwin wrote. But it is also true that the little pieces of history move around at a tremendous speed, settling with a not always clear logic and rarely settling for long. And perhaps more interesting than my not being the only black person in the village is the plain fact that many of the other people I saw were also foreigners. This was the biggest change of all. If back then the village had a pious and convalescent air about it, the feel of a lesser lord's, it is much busier now, packed with visitors from other parts of Switzerland, Germany, France, Italy, and all over Europe, Asia, and the Americas. It has become the most popular thermal resort in the Alps. The municipal baths were full. There are hotels on every street at every price point, and there are restaurants and luxury goods shops. If you wish to buy an eye-wateringly costly watch at 4,600 feet above sea level, it is not possible to do so. The better hotels have their own thermal pools. At the Hotel Mercure Bristol, I took an elevator down to the spa and sat in the dry sauna. A few minutes later, I slipped into the pool and floated outside in the warm water. Others were there, but not many. A light rain fell. We were ringed by mountains and held in the immortal blue. In her brilliant Harlem is Nowhere, Sharifa Rhodes Pitts writes, "In almost every essay James Baldwin wrote about Harlem, there's a moment when he commits a literary sleight of hand so particular that if he had been an athlete, sportscasters would have codified the maneuver and named it the Jimmy. I think of it in cinematic terms because its effect reminds me of a technique wherein camera operators pan out by starting out with a tight shot and zoom out to a wide view while the lens remains focused on a point in the distance." End quote. This move, this sudden widening of focus, is present even in his essays that are not about Harlem. In Stranger in the Village, there's a passage about 7 pages in which one can feel the rhetoric revving up as Baldwin prepares to live behind the calm, fabular atmosphere of the opening section. Of the villagers, he writes, "These people cannot be, from the point of view of power, strangers anywhere in the world. They have made the modern world, in effect, even if they do not know it. The most illiterate among them is related, in a way that I am not, to Dante, Shakespeare, Michelangelo, Aeschylus, Da Vinci, Rembrandt, and Racine. The cathedral at Chartres says something to them which it cannot say to me, as indeed would New York's Empire State Building, should anyone here ever see it. Out of their hymns and dances come Beethoven and Bach. Go back a few centuries, and they are in their full glory. But I am in Africa, watching the conquerors arrive." What is this list about? Does it truly bother Baldwin that the people of Leukerbad are related through some faint familiarity to Chartres? That some distant genetic thread links them to the Beethoven string quartets? After all, as he argues later in the essay, no one can deny the impact of, quote, "the presence of the Negro has had on the American character." He understands the truth and the art in Bessie Smith's work. He does not and cannot, I want to believe, rate the blues below Bach. But there was a certain narrowness in received ideas of black culture in the 1950s. In the time since then, there has been enough black cultural achievement from which to compile an all-star team. There's been Coltrane and Monk and Miles and Ella and Billy and Aretha. Toni Morrison, Wale Soyinka, and Derek Walcott happened, as have Audre Lorde and Chinua Achebe and Bob Marley. The body was not abandoned for the mind's sake. Alvin Ailey, Arthur Ashe, and Michael Jordan happened too. The source of jazz and blues also gave the world hip-hop, Afrobeat, dancehall, and house. And yes, when James Baldwin himself died in 1987, he too was recognized as an all-star. Thinking further about the cathedral at Chartres, about the greatness of that achievement, and about how, in his view, it included blacks only in the negative, as devils, Baldwin writes that the American Negro has arrived at his identity by virtue of the absoluteness of his estrangement from his past. But the distant African past has also become much more available than it was in 1953. It would not occur to me to think that centuries ago I was, quote, in Africa, watching the conquerors arrive. But I suspect that for Baldwin, it is in part a rhetorical move, a grim cadence to which to end a paragraph. In another essay called A Question of Identity, he writes, "The truth about that past is not that it is too brief or too superficial, but only that we, having turned our faces so resolutely away from it, have never demanded from it what it has to give." End quote. The 14th century court artist of Ife made bronze sculptures using a complicated casting process lost to Europe since antiquity, and which was not rediscovered there until the Renaissance. Ife's sculptures are equal to the works of Ghiberti or Donatello. From their precision and formal sumptuousness, we can extrapolate the contours of a great monarchy, a network of sophisticated ateliers, and a cosmopolitan world of trade and knowledge. And it was not only Ife. All of West Africa was a cultural ferment. From the egalitarian government of the Igbo to the gold work of the Ashanti courts, the brass sculpture of Benin, the military achievement of the Madinka Empire, and the musical virtuosi who praised those war heroes. This was a region of the world too deeply invested in art and life to simply be reduced to a caricature of watching the conquerors arrive. We know better now. We know it with a stack of corroborating scholarship, and we know it implicitly, so that even making a list of the accomplishments feels faintly tedious and is helpful mainly as a counter to Eurocentrism. There is no world in which I would surrender the intimidating beauty of Yoruba language poetry for, say, Shakespeare's sonnets, nor one in which I'd prefer the chamber orchestras of Brandenburg to the choras of Mali. I'm happy to own all of it. This carefree confidence is, in part, the gift of time. It is a dividend of the struggle of people from earlier generations. I feel no alienation in museums. But this question of filiation tormented Baldwin considerably. He was sensitive to what was great in world art and sensitive to his own sense of exclusion from it. He made a similar list in the title essay of Notes of a Native Son. One begins to feel that lists like this had been flung at him during arguments. Quote, "In some subtle way, in a really profound way, I brought to Shakespeare, Bach, Rembrandt, to the stones of Paris, to the Cathedral of Chartres, and the Empire State Building, a special attitude. These were not really my creations. They did not contain my history. I might search them in vain forever for any reflection of myself. I was an interloper. This was not my heritage." End quote. The lines throb with sadness. What he loves does not love him in return. This is where I part ways with Baldwin. I disagree not with his particular sorrow, but with the self-abnegation that pinned him to it. Bach, so profoundly human, is my heritage. I am not an interloper when I look at a Rembrandt portrait. I care for them more than some white people do, just as some white people care more for aspects of African art than I do. I can oppose white supremacy and still rejoice in Gothic architecture. In this, I stand with Ralph Ellison. Quote, "The values of my own people are neither white nor black. They're American. Nor can I see how they could be anything else, since we're people who are involved in the texture of the American experience." End quote. And yet I, born in the United States more than half a century after Baldwin, continue to understand, because I have experienced in my own body, the undimmed fury he felt about pervasive, limiting racism. In his writing, there's a hunger for life, for all of it, and a strong wish to not be accounted nothing, a mere nigger, when he knows himself to be so much. And this so much is neither a matter of ego about his writing nor an anxiety about his fame in New York or Paris. It is about the incontestable fundamentals of a person: pleasure, sorrow, love, humor, grief, and the complexity of the interior landscape that sustains those feelings. Baldwin was astonished that anyone anywhere should question these fundamentals, thereby burdening him with the supreme waste of time that racism is, let alone so many people in so many places. This unflagging ability to be shocked rises like steam off his written pages. The rage of the disesteemed is personally fruitless, he writes, but it is also absolutely inevitable. Lugerbad gave Baldwin a way to think about white supremacy from its first principles. It was as though he had found it in its simplest form there. The men who suggested that he learn to ski so that they might mock him. The villagers who accused him behind his back of being a firewood thief. The ones who wished to touch his hair and suggest that he grow it out and make himself a winter coat. And the children who, quote, having been taught that the devil is a black man, scream in genuine anguish, end quote, as he approached. Baldwin saw these as prototypes, preserved like silicanths, of attitudes that had evolved into the more intimate, intricate, familiar, and obscene American forms of white supremacy that he already knew so well. It is a beautiful village. I like the mountain air. But when I return to my room from the thermal baths or from strolling in the streets with my camera, I read the news online. There I find an unending sequence of crises in the Middle East, in Africa, in Russia, and everywhere else, really. Pain was general. But within that larger distress was a set of linked stories. And thinking about Stranger in the Village, thinking with its help, was like injecting a contrast dye into my encounter with the news. The American police continued shooting unarmed black men, or killing them in other ways. The protests that followed in black communities were countered with violence by a police force that is becoming indistinguishable from an invading army. People began to see a connection between the various events. The shootings, the fatal chokehold, the stories of who was not given life-saving medication. And black communities were flooded with outrage and grief. In all of this, a smaller, less significant story, but one that nevertheless signified, caught my attention. The mayor of New York and his police chief, have a public policy obsession with cleaning, with cleansing. And they decided that arresting members of the dance troupes that perform in moving subway cars is one of the ways to clean up the city. I read the excuses for this becoming a priority. Some people fear being seriously injured by an errant kick. It has not happened, but they sure fear it. Some people consider it a nuisance. Some policymakers believe that going after misdemeanors is a way of preempting major crimes. And so, to combat this menace of dancers, the police moved in. They began chasing and harassing and handcuffing. The problem was dancers, and the dancers were, for the most part, black boys. The newspapers took the same tone as the government, a sniffy dismissal of the performers. And yet these same dancers are a bright spark in the day, a moment of unregulated beauty, artists with talents unimaginable to their audience. What kind of thinker would consider and abolish their abolition and improvement in city life? No one considers Halloween trick-or-treaters a public menace. Maybe some people do, I don't know. There's no law enforcement against people selling Girl Scout cookies or against Jehovah's Witnesses. But the black body comes prejudged, and as a result, it is placed in needless jeopardy. To be black is to bear the brunt of selective enforcement of the law and to inhabit a psychic unsteadiness in which there's no guarantee of personal safety. You are a black body first before you are a kid walking down the street or a Harvard professor who has misplaced his keys. William Hazlitt, in an 1821 essay entitled The Indian Jugglers, wrote words that I think of when I see a great athlete or dancer. Quote, "Man, thou art a wonderful animal, and thy ways past finding out. Thou canst do strange things, but thou turnest them to little account. To conceive of this effort of extraordinary dexterity distracts the imagination and makes admiration breathless." End quote. In the presence of the admirable, some are breathless, not with admiration, but with rage. They object to the presence of the black body, an unarmed boy in a street, a man buying a toy, a dancer in the subway, a bystander, as much as they object to the presence of the black mind. And simultaneous with these erasures is the unending collection of profit from black labor. Throughout the culture, there are imitations of the gait, bearing, and dress of the black body, a vampiric everything but the burden co-optation of black life. Leukerbad is ringed by mountains, the Dauben Horn, the Torrent Horn, the Rinderhorn, a high mountain pass called the Gemmi, another 2,800 feet above the village, connects the canton of Valais with the Bernese Oberland. Through this landscape, craggy, barren places and verdant elsewhere, a textbook instance of the sublime, one moves as though through a dream. The Gemmi Pass is famous for good reason, and Goethe was there, as were Byron, Twain, and Picasso. The pass is mentioned in a Sherlock Holmes adventure when Holmes crosses it on his way to the fateful meeting with Professor Moriarty at Reichenbach Falls. There was bad weather the day I went up, rain and fog, but it was good luck, as it meant I was alone on the trails. While there, I remember a story that Lucien Happersberger told about Baldwin going out on a hike in these mountains. Baldwin had lost his footing during the ascent, and the situation was precarious for a moment. But Happersberger, who was an experienced climber, reached out a hand, and Baldwin was saved. It was out of this frightening moment, this appealingly biblical moment, that Baldwin got the title for the book he had been struggling to write, Go Tell It on the Mountain. If Leukerbad was his mountain pulpit, the United States was his audience. The remote village gave him a sharper view of what things looked like back home. He was a stranger in Leukerbad, Baldwin wrote, but there was no possibility for blacks to be strangers in the United States, nor for whites to achieve the fantasy of an all-white America purged of blacks. This fantasy about the disposability of black life is a constant in American history. And I should mention here that we're, of course, on the unceded territory of other people who were here before black people and white people, and there's a major fantasy about their disposability as well. It takes a while to understand that this disposability continues. It takes whites a while to understand it. It takes non-black people of color a while to understand it. And it takes some blacks, whether they've always lived in the U.S. or latecomers like myself, weaned elsewhere on other struggles, a while to understand it. American racism has many moving parts and has had enough centuries in which to evolve an impressive camouflage. It can hoard its malice in great stillness for a long time, all the while pretending to look the other way. Like misogyny, it is atmospheric. You don't see it at first, but understanding comes. Quote, people who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction, and anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence long after that innocence is dead turns himself into a monster. End quote. The news of the day, old news but raw as a fresh wound, is that black American life is disposable from the point of view of policing, sentencing, economic policy, and countless terrifying forms of disregard. There's a vivid performance of innocence, but there's no actual innocence left. The moral ledger remains so far in the negative that we can't even get started on the question of reparations. James Baldwin wrote Stranger in the Village more than 60 years ago. Now what? Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Oh. That was a little bit intense, so I hope we can still be friends.
Now what? That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Should we start at a level of abstraction, like, you know, you wrote of Baldwin's precipitous eloquence. And, you know, no one here in this audience wouldn't have been touched by your own eloquence in that brilliant reading. So can I just ask you, what are you going for when you write?
Thank you.
For example, I was thinking, like, you know, that little phrase you had, which is a wonderful phrase, like injecting a contrast dye, you know, into this thing of news, whatever it was. Yeah?
I think of eloquence as maybe the preconditions out of which the work begins. You don't go into the work to try to find eloquence in it. You approach with a certain eloquence, and then you actually try to pull back from that so that the challenge becomes finding the words that fit the occasion, but expunging anything that is superfluous, anything that is merely performative. I think there was something about this particular essay where, I mean, you know, sorry, the light's a little bit bright. This is not my regular life, if you can believe it. You're reading someone like James Baldwin, and there is a kind of contagion of his prose. He's a writer of such immense flair that I think it ended up pushing this particular essay a little bit in that direction. And very often I'm actually a little bit happier, toning down the fireworks a little bit. But in general, you know, the difference between the first draft and the 12th draft is that the 12th draft is more precise and less eloquent.
That's a good answer.
Are you going to do that all night?
You know, the way in which the American public discovered you was the novel.
I like that. It makes me feel like a rare element. I feel like tantalum.
Are you going to do that all night?
I might.
Was through the beauty of Open City. And you were pleased by the fact that James Wood, in his wonderful review in The New Yorker, which I remember saying to you was not a review, it was a song. He noted the influence of Enigma of Arrival, Naipaul's Enigma of Arrival. Now, when Naipaul was given the Nobel Prize, the citation had this line that I want to read to you and then ask you to tell me a little bit about what is the different thing that you might be doing in Open City. So the citation said, in his masterpiece, The Enigma of Arrival, Naipaul visits the reality of England like an anthropologist studying some hitherto unexplored native tribe deep in the jungle. With apparently short-sighted and random observations, he creates an unrelenting image of the placid collapse of the old colonial ruling culture and the demise of European neighborhoods. What sort of enigma of arrival are you describing in Open City?
It was interesting that Wood mentioned that in his review, because very few other sort of
critics, no one else mentioned
it. Yeah, nobody else mentioned, you know, so that, and it was a book that was a little bit about the content, but the rhythm of that book, the prose rhythms of it, were something I sort of had in my ear a bit while writing mine. Uh, I mean, I have always sort of liked the school of writing that is based on the idea of a Martian visiting Earth. You know, over-describe, act as if we've never seen it before. And especially when you're approaching a subject like New York City that has an entire library full of books written about it, you cannot make a bid for originality. What you can try to do is testify to where you are and where you're beginning. And so I think I surrendered any great bid for originality or brilliance. And in that book, I just wanted to make it feel testimonial. I've created this fictional character. His name is Julius, and he's given a testimony of a year of his life in the city. That's all. Just almost as if somebody's saying, well, so Julius, tell me, what has the past year in the city been like for you? And by the way, we've never heard of New York City. And so he describes the streets. He describes the buildings. He describes those sensations that we've all observed 1,001 times, but that maybe because they're so obvious, are not so often set down in writing. And I just found through doing that, there was like accumulation and accumulative drift that then became its own texture. And that's what the book was. So the gift of being a stranger everywhere is something I have learned not just from Naipaul's work, but from all the writers I admire.
They are?
Amitava Kumar, for example. In an early book that I adored called London, Bombay, London, New York. In each of these things, places, manages just to give a kind of vivid not-at-homeness that he conveys in the stories he tells about moving through them. Language that is ferociously intelligent without being academic. And people who wrote and thought like that became my ideal, and I think it's also true of a lot of the work of John Berger, whom we both admire very much. And several other writers from which we get it. But the ability to always be surprised by where you are is a particular clan within the broad church of writing. And that's the one to which you're a member and I'm an associate. But my file is up for review. So... But that's where I want to be, the perpetual stranger. Yeah.
I think I'm trying to look for something. I hope I find very quickly. Berger is calling some.
No.
You know, Teju just mentioned that he admires these writers, Berger or Sebald, others that we can think about. But what I personally find very attractive about Teju's writing is that he's not simply doing what they do, he's actively rewriting them from his place. And so for those folks who have been living away from, let's say, the world of Twitter, I just want to have Teju give you a little taste of how he, in a series of 7 tweets, rewrote the first lines of classic novels.
We're going to do this?
Yeah. Do you mind reading from here?
No.
And then it goes on the next one.
Mrs. Dalloway said she would buy the flowers herself. Pity. A signature strike leveled the florist. Call me Ishmael. I was a young man of military age. I was immolated at my wedding. My parents are inconsolable. I was never aware of the humor in these, but this is a peculiarly dark crowd. stately, plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead bearing a bowl of lather. A bomb whistled in. Blood on the walls, fire from heaven. I am an invisible man. My name is unknown. My loves are a mystery. But an unmanned aerial vehicle from a secret location has come for me. I don't know. Someone must have slandered Joseph K. For one morning, without having done anything truly wrong, he was killed by predator drone. Okonkwo was well known throughout the nine villages and even beyond. His torso was found, not his head. Mother died today. The program saves American lives.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are you guys going to discuss this with your therapist later this week? He was telling the most horrible stories, and I just was just laughing.
Why did he quit Twitter?
He got noisy.
Yeah.
But also, you know, it was good. It was a good space. We did some work on there, and there was conversations with people. And never let the last good thing you did be your enemy. It's very important to me. Just quit. Just go. I didn't want people to say, oh, remember when he used to be good at Twitter? So I used Twitter as a very creative space, and after a while, good. Let's do something else. And I started doing the
Instagram.
No. I took the photography critic gig after Twitter.
Yes.
You can't find time for everything. So
I hereby appeal to all of Teju Cole's 190,000 followers to follow me instead.
Yeah, that's right.
Teju is also on Instagram, doing some very interesting stuff. And for folks who are interested in checking that out, I'd encourage you to do that. Because people were laughing. Let's make it a little serious. In your review of a wonderful book, Wave, by Sonali Darangala, you quote her where she says, writing is a much better quality of agony than trying to forget. Writing is a much better quality of agony than trying to forget. What do you think that means for her? What is it, and what does writing mean for you? Can I lead you there? Writing is a much better quality of agony.
I think it was Robert Frost. Somebody asked him to explain what a poem is, and he said, do you want me to say it worse? If I say it different from that, I'll say it worse. Writing is a much better quality of agony than trying to forget. Yeah. Right? I mean, it can restore something to you. It still hurts. What happened with this woman?
Yeah, tell the story if you don't mind.
We all have our nightmares. And what happened to her was the ultimate nightmare. Because one morning, one December morning, about a decade ago, she is an academic who lives in the UK, and she'd gone on vacation. And the water came in. It was the morning of the tsunami. And she was in Sri Lanka. Her parents live there, but she came over from the UK with her family, with her husband and her two sons, 8 and 6. And so in the course of one morning, she lost the boys and her husband and her father and her mother and her best friend. And this book, Wave, is about her barely surviving that grief. It is one of the most pained and intense books that I know. And writing it was a way for her to move ever so slightly closer to life. Because then she could describe the meals that they made together, and the drives in the countryside, and the boys in the back seat acting up, and gross out humor, and their fascinations. And her husband, they dated since they were 19 years old. And just bring them all a little bit closer into the light. Most of us, almost none of us, will ever approach a limit case like that in our lives. But what the limit case does is that it tells us that writing, what is written down, what James Salter says, only those things that are written down have any possibility of being remembered. That it has a peculiar restorative power. One afternoon in County Clare, and it would have vanished, beautiful as it was, for all time. But Heaney writes it down in the exact words that the experience deserves, and now it is preserved for all ages to come. Only writing can accomplish such a miracle.
I think you're a narrator in Open City because he has a quality of observation. Going into a museum, seeing pictures, seeing a peculiar stillness about them, and remembering that the painter was himself deaf, and the subjects he was painting were deaf children. Because of that quality of observation, or other things that the novel offers, for example, the birds flying into the Statue of Liberty and dying. Those are indelible images. They also offer testimony, you know? They are offering us testimony of about, for example, the black slaves, the graves over which some of New York was built, etc. So I was thinking that, or that essay that you just read to us, parts of which certainly left us breathless, you're also registering pain and doing something else with it. What is that something else? I mean, where you, how do you, do you think about, like, okay, what am I doing? What are you doing?
I mean, suddenly I just heard my mother's voice. What are you doing? What are you? What do you think you're doing? I mean, you definitely go in there with a commitment, a loyalty to the disregarded things of the world. That's for sure. You know. And that's a clan that's related to this other clan I talked about. Those of us who want to see things out of the corner of our eye.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
The little things, the small things, the little moment, not the big story, but the small story.
Yeah.
Now, in any particular situation, you have to be patient, you pay attention, and then you see what small moment that will give to you. Home Products, for example, you have that scene, you know, where the narrator goes on a set. Everybody else would be fascinated by what Bollywood is doing, the star, their lives, and all of this. And what you had was a set piece about the guard and the dog and the guards and their banter, their lives. The dog is going to come back as a hero if he's good in this life. And that is how I wish to write. I want to step back and see what else might be going on. I don't object to Open City being described as a 9/11 novel. It is. It's just my idea of what 9/11 is about, which is that it is 9/11, the aftermath of that event, contains an infinity of tiny moments that are worth preserving. Deeply private, deeply personal. Everybody who's moving through the city is living inside a hush and a stillness. When Virginia Woolf writes about a moth bashing itself against a window, struggling to get out. At that very moment, people are dying in their thousands on the Somme. It's during World War I. The moth becomes a testament to an observed moment that can draw us into a peculiar sympathy we might not have anticipated. War movies don't do anything for me, really. But if somebody can find a moment of human feeling, human intensity, I love the pregnant moment before something happens. I love the long aftermath and how that is dealt with. And for that reason, I am drawn to the poets of aftermath and the writers of solitude and those who know how to evoke insomnia.
Yeah.
You know, the moments of pure existential isolation. A space opens up suddenly inside you and it's like a chasm. And then something can happen. You know, when a writer says, no hurry, we're in this space together and something's going to happen. And isn't that what we try to do? I mean...
Yeah. In your case, there's one thing that and I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk about this. I also think what you're doing is, in the same way as you talking about Black Lives Matter, paid attention to the dancers, which, you know, instead of fulminating about the more obvious thing about people being killed, here you were talking about the persecution of the wild black body. Not only that what has not been paid attention to is something that draws your eye, I also think that unlike many others, you allow the reader to or your viewer to cultivate doubt.
Mm-hmm.
There is a risk, you know, there are many things that you're not uncertain about, but it's also a space for cultivating ambivalence, doubt. And I wonder whether...
Yeah, I'm really glad you picked up on that little section of it, because James Baldwin is pretty much a secular saint now. I think, as far as the people I'm talking to, the stuff I see cited, the stuff I read in terms of, you know, public American life, especially when you're thinking about race and condition of the country. I think after Martin Luther King Jr., he's the most cited person. He's got a quote to fit every situation, you know? I mean, James Baldwin becomes the way you get, you know, girls these days, or boys, you know, more apropos. Like, oh, you know, he quoted James Baldwin, you know, I guess he's hot to trot, you know, let's do it. See you on Saturday, you know? Love the Baldwin quote. So there's nothing controversial about me writing a deep and warmly appreciative piece about James Baldwin. There's nothing controversial about saying Black Lives Matter unless you're dealing with psychopaths. I know there are a few. When I'm writing a piece like that, I think it's important for me to say, look, we're in this space and we do have to do a little bit of thinking. I cannot simply be a performing crowd pleaser and just tell you exactly what you think you know and what you want to know already. I had people take me to task for saying that I disagree with Baldwin about, you know, museums and whatever, the cathedral and all of that. It's almost as if nobody's allowed to actually have a point of view, you know. Somebody said to me that, oh, you would not like Shakespeare if you really understood what black pain was about. Like, are you fucking kidding me? Seriously? You know? And I think those forms of dissent are so important, little as they might be. And it's funny that in a piece like that, it's the dancers on the train that are the most controversial part. Because, in fact, most people I know don't like them. People of any color. They're like, eh, annoying. And I want to say, well, you know what? No. Slow down, stop, and think about what's at stake. It's not about you all the time. And I think I do live in a little bit of fear of becoming excessively conciliatory. I have my enthusiasms and I write about them, and I become this guy who writes about what he loves. And every now and again, you do actually have to. I mean, this is a very mild case, but every now and again, you have to stick the knife in and say, "Well, no. I can stand for this, and I will not be bullied into thinking."
Okay, let's stick the knife in. Who was it?
I feel like I'm about to get into trouble.
Was it Wolf Blitzer? Who was it on CNN who said, "Is Ebola the ISIS of?"
They're all idiots.
Okay, no. A few lines. Just tell them a little bit about what did you hear, and then read a few lines from that.
Okay.
Because this is about being unafraid to go over the top, and
I wrote a little piece for the New Yorker's online site when the Ebola hysteria went out of control. And there was a sort of a chyron on CNN that said, you know, could Ebola be the ISIS of biological agents? Just asking. Hashtag. Just saying. Some have said. And I had had enough of that shit, so I wrote this piece. Is Ebola the ISIS of biological agents? Is Ebola the Boko Haram of AIDS? Is Ebola the Al-Shabaab of a dengue fever? Some say Ebola is the Milosevic of West Nile virus. Others say Ebola is the Ku Klux Klan of paper cuts. It's obvious that Ebola is the flight MH370 of flight MH17. But at some point, the question must be asked whether Ebola isn't also the Narendra Modi of sleeping sickness. And I don't mean to offend anyone's sensitivities, but there's more and more reason to believe that Ebola is the Sonny Abacha of having some trouble peeing. At first, there was understandably the suspicion that Ebola was the Hitler of apartheid. But now it has become abundantly clear that Ebola is actually the George W. Bush of being forced to listen to someone's podcast. The World Health Organization calls it the Putin of Stalin. In layperson's terms, that's like saying it's the Stalin of U2. Now we're seeing the idea thrown around that it could be the Black Hand of the Black Death, not to mention the Red Peril of the Red Plague. And it goes on.
No, you have to finish it. Man, you have to read the whole thing. Okay. You're enjoying it.
If you don't want to go that far, you have to at least admit that Ebola is the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb of stage 4 brain cancer. At this point, it's very possible that Ebola could become airborne and turn into the Tea Party of extreme climate events. Throughout the country of Africa, Ebola is the Abu Ghraib of think pieces. Look, I'm not the politically correct type, so I'm just going to put this out there. Ebola is the neo-Nazism of niggling knee injuries. The kind of threat it poses to the American way of life essentially makes it the North Korea of peanut allergies. I'm not going to lie to you, and I don't care what color you are. You could be red, green, blue, purple, whatever. You need to understand that Ebola, the Obama of Osama, but don't quote me, is literally the some of my best friends are black of not all men. But the burning question no one has raised yet is whether Ebola is the Newsweek of halitosis. We'll get to the phones in a moment and get your take on this. But first, let me open up the discussion to our panel and ask whether Ebola is merely the Fox News of explosive incontinence or whether the situation is much worse than that and Ebola is, in fact, the CNN of CNN. There you go. Thanks.
That's great.
You know, pieces like that are a real problem because, I write an essay, I slave over it for 6 weeks, get every word right, go through it. I wrote that on a 30-minute, on a one-hour-long flight. And I got off the plane and I called my editor and I said, I have this piece. Please say no, I'm embarrassed. And she said, of course we're going to publish that. Are you crazy? So... it's always the things that you... And they're going to say, you know, he died and he was the one who wrote the Ebola piece.
It's coming out in the new essay collection also, by the way. Well, that's the thing. You should have said yes to me when I asked you to have a drink this evening because you're working hard on that other piece that you have to...
Yeah.
Which brings me to the question about what you're doing these days in terms of writing for the New York Times magazine. You know, there's that line of Fondace about the novel being like a camera walking down the street. Do you remember that line?
Yes.
Yeah. You've always been like that, you know?
I'm like a camera walking down a street?
A camera with 1,000 eyes.
The lyrics in this guy, you know, it's just...
And... So perhaps you could share with us.
I don't know what happened with photography. It just became almost like a convenient analogy for all the things that interest me. And then I went very deep into doing photography and writing about it. The magic in photos remains irreducible. I would not have thought I had 12 long essays in me over the course of a year. Apparently I do. The power of the fear of a deadline is an amazing thing. And over this next year, I have to produce another 12. It's just interesting. It's quite challenging for me. I don't think I've had anything quite so formal or serious to do before for an audience of that size. But what I've had to learn to do is be productive in hotel rooms. I'm traveling. I'm doing other things. And the piece has to be filed. And I have to get on the phone. You know, over the connection, the Wi-Fi has to work with my editor. And, you know, there are people like him saying, you know, meet me for a drink. And I have to be a nerd and be like, I'm sorry. Peace has to get in, but, you know.
No, work is important.
Thank you. Thank you for your permission. And then just, what's also worth saying here is that I'm not, and I'll speak for us collectively, I don't think we're on stage here because we're... more worthy or more interesting, or you're more worthy and more interesting. I'm not worthy or more interesting than anybody in the audience. You know, we are all perfect contemporaries. We all live life with the same density of experience and with the same texture of aliveness. And I think anybody over there could be over here and speak interestingly about their experience of life, and I would want to listen to it. What I find is that I need to be responsible to the various opportunities I have to pursue a wide range of interests and actually have that be what I do for a living. And that's why I want to do all of it, almost to the point of fatigue, because not doing it would feel like spurning the opportunity that's been given to me. My God, I know people who would love to write novels and, you know, write about photography and hang out in the nice places in Santa Fe and talk to audiences and, you know, but they have to earn a living in another way and there's no additional time to do it. So you get the chance to do it. Don't fuck it up. That's a little thing I'm trying to live up to. Yeah.
There's an aphoristic clarity about that last statement, which sort of forbids any further inquiry. Don't fuck it up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.